Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining today's teleconference. The call will be recorded, so please follow up with us after the call if you'd like to access a recording. And thank you to today's guests for joining us and all of you on the line. With Governor Cuomo declining to include marijuana legalization in New York State budget, which was finalized yesterday, that means it now must get enacted via standalone legislation in the coming months. In a radio interview yesterday, Cuomo did double down on his previous commitments to pass a legalization law this year. While he had previously committed to including it in the state budget, he now insists it can be passed into law before the legislative session ends in June. Last week, the New York City Council also approved resolutions in support of DPA's model for equitable marijuana legalization rooted in economic and racial justice. Last week, 200 members of DPA's Start Smart Coalition, along with unlikely allies from across the state, held a three-hour rally at the state legislature in Albany. On today's call, we'll be hearing from some of the key members of DPA's Start Smart New York campaign. But before we do that, I want to note some of the national context here. As in New York, national public opinion around marijuana has rapidly shifted in recent years. Nearly two-thirds of the American public now supports marijuana legalization, including a majority of Republicans and older adults. This shift may be in part a reflection of the success of state marijuana laws in the first 10 states to legalize marijuana, beginning with Colorado and Washington in 2012. In these states, marijuana-related arrests have plummeted, saving states millions of dollars and preventing the criminalization of thousands of people. Youth marijuana use has not increased in these states. There have been reductions in opioid overdose deaths and untreated opioid use disorders. DUI arrests for driving under the influence of alcohol and other drugs have declined. The legal marijuana industry is creating hundreds of thousands of jobs, and states are filling their coffers with hundreds of millions of dollars in new tax revenues from marijuana and allocating them for social good, funding education, school construction, early literacy, behavioral health, and alcohol and drug treatment. The shift in marijuana politics might be best measured by the number of leading presidential hopefuls coming out in support of marijuana legalization, such as Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. The Drug Policy Alliance has played a pivotal role in marijuana legalization over the past 25 years, first for medical purposes and then for all adults. DPA is the only organization that's played a key role in each of the successful ballot initiatives that have legalized marijuana. California's Proposition 64, which DPA played a key leadership role in drafting and passing in 2016, set a new bar for marijuana legalization with provisions for record expungement, equity in licensing, and reinvestment in communities that have been most harmed. DPA is currently leading campaigns to legalize marijuana in our resident states of New York, New Jersey, and New Mexico, as well as at the federal level, with an emphasis on creating a well-regulated and inclusive marijuana industry that is rooted in racial and economic justice. I'll now turn the call over to my esteemed colleague, Cassandra Frederique, DPA's New York State Director, who will add some more context.
Thank you, Jag, and thank you everyone for joining us on the call. I want to give a special shout out to the reporters who are on the line, because I know that you probably just got home, considering all that has happened in the last 10 days. I want to start off by talking about where we are right now here in New York around marijuana legalization and recognize that we are here because advocates have pushed and pushed and pushed for marijuana regulation to be a part of the larger criminal justice agenda of New York State and within the legislature and putting it on the record for Governor Cuomo. This conversation around marijuana legalization is not per chance. It has been cited many times that only a few years ago was Governor Cuomo still referring to marijuana as a gateway drug. And what we have seen and how things have moved in New York has only been out of as a direct result of advocacy that has happened statewide and in large part by the work that our coalition Start Smart New York has done in the last couple of years. When Governor Cuomo talked about marijuana legalization in December during his FDR speech, he talked about why it needed to be a conversation or an initiative based in criminal justice reform. In January 2019, when he did his State of the State, and he talked about it, he said that cannabis regulation needs to be about empowering poor communities and not enriching corporations. And then as we move forward through the budget process, we saw the governor come in and out of the conversation, in the beginning forcefully saying that this is something that could happen in the budget. And then closer to the end of the budget, we saw that Governor Cuomo's messaging around marijuana legalization did a 180, where he started saying that marijuana legalization was not going to happen in the budget. And while the legislative leaders like Carl Heastie and Andrea Stewart Cousins were both timidly saying things like, yeah, we still think there's enough time, Governor Cuomo really doused a lot of water on the kind of fire that was being burned for marijuana legalization. And there was never any clarity as to why that shift happened. But our work with the Start Smart Coalition paid quite a bit of attention to that, recognizing the way that Cuomo plays Cuomo games. And for the thing is, as an organization that has worked on marijuana reform for the longest time in New York, we are very clear about what Cuomo's playbook has been around marijuana reform work. And so some on the call might know that this situation that we're in right now is very similar to the situation that we were in 2013 and in 2014, dealing with marijuana arrests and further decriminalization, as well as medical marijuana, respectively. And so in the case of 2013, Cuomo comes out and says forcefully, we are going to deal with marijuana arrests and we're going to further push for marijuana decriminalization. It tried to go in the budget. It didn't make it in the budget. We tried to do it at the end of the year. It did not happen. In 2014, very similar, we were talking about medical marijuana. We tried to go in the budget. It did not happen. And then in June of that year, Cuomo did essentially a big ugly with medical marijuana, which resulted in the most restrictive medical marijuana program, which was inaccessible due to cost and geography. And the industry was basically given away to out-of-state interests that were very moneyed. And so in this moment, in 2019, 5 years since medical marijuana has passed in New York State, we're very aware of how marijuana reform is something that is consistently evolving and how often Cuomo stays committed or not committed. And so oftentimes people ask our coalition, they ask me directly, you know, what do you think? Were you disappointed? And as someone who's been doing campaign work around drugs in a little less than a decade here in New York, I'm very aware of how what the Cuomo calculus is. And it seems very clear that while Governor Cuomo does recognize that marijuana reform is something that he cannot avoid, it is something that I think he's trying to figure out how to navigate in order for him to best position himself as a person that gets the credit of getting the job done. But part of the thing that we have to be cognizant of is that the conversation around marijuana legalization has borne out of a Cuomo promise that he did not keep. He did not make sure that marijuana arrests stopped. And that's why the arrest rate is the highest it's ever been. And that the arrest rates in upstate New York are double that of what they were in the 1990s. And so our conversation around marijuana regulation comes out of the recognition that Cuomo didn't get the job done in 2013. And the job that he did get done with medical was not enough in order for us to get to a place, which is why you see that Governor Cuomo's Cannabis Regulation Taxation Act does adds medical and hemp into the conversation with adult youth because he has to clean up some of the stuff that he has put forward. And so we want to be really clear that as we move towards regulation here in New York State, that the how is very important. And that the how is actually anchored in the experience of people that have been most impacted, those that have been arrested, those that have records, those that have lost custody of their kids, those that have been kicked out of public housing, those that have been deported, and not whether or not if Governor Cuomo thinks it's politically expedient. And so we look forward to moving the fight forward in trying to get legalization passed by June. But we are very clear that there is a list of principles that our legislative leaders, Assembly Majority Leader Crystal Peoples-Stokes and Senate Finance Chair Liz Krueger have been very clear about, that are very aligned with the way that DPA and our Start Smart Coalition partners have committed to, that we're not going to allow regulation to be shoehorned in a big ugly at the end of June, but actually we're going to fight for a legislative response that is actually as comprehensive as the damage that has been done, that Governor Cuomo himself has let to continue based on his inability to close the deal on ending marijuana arrests back in 2013.
Thank you so much, Cassandra. Our next speaker will be David Nathan. He's president and board of directors of Doctors for Cannabis Reform, a distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, and a clinical associate professor of psychology at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. He's a practicing Harvard-educated psychiatrist who will address the urgent need to legalize from the medical community's perspective. David?
Thank you so much. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Great. So thank you for that, Jag. Couple just minor corrections. The name of the organization is Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. We go beyond reform, and I can explain why. And the other thing is that I'm actually an associate clinical professor of the Department of Psychiatry, not psychology. Common mistake. Half my family still thinks I dropped out of medical school to be a psychiatrist, so no worries. So I'm talking to you today from the standpoint of public health and social justice, insofar as social justice is a public health issue, and I'll explain. Doctors for Cannabis Regulation, as some of you may know, is the first and leading organization of physicians, a national organization of physicians dedicated to the legalization and above all the effective regulation of cannabis in the United States. You can't have regulation without legalization. And if it's going to be legalized, then cannabis needs to be regulated well. We launched in 2016 with our Declaration of Principles that was co-signed by over 50 founding members who were prominent physicians from around the country, including such dignitaries as former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders and integrative medicine pioneer Andrew Weil. Subsequent to our Declaration of Principles that lays out the case for legalization and regulation, we created our platform of regulations, which I won't go through in its entirety. It's about seven main points of what every regulatory framework for cannabis should look like around the country. You can find that as well as our mission statement at dfcr.com. That's Doctors for Cannabis Regulation. .org, dfcr.org. We are engaged in education and advocacy, and we've done special projects. We're working right now with NFL players to try to get the ban on cannabis overturned in the NFL. And we're actively involved in New York State, where we have some leaders of medicine. One that I would definitely highlight is Dr. Julia Arnston, who is a full professor of medicine, psychiatry, and epidemiology at Albert Einstein Medical School, and she's the chair of medicine at the Montefiore Hospital in the Bronx. She's also the founder of the first cannabis medical cannabis clinic for underserved populations in the Bronx. So really neat lady. And she just got back from vacation, or I would have her speaking in my stead. I'm a New Jersey-based doctor, but I certainly spend plenty of time in New York, and I've been interacting with the advocacy folks up there. And the message that I bring to New York is the message that was quoted in the report by the commission that Governor Cuomo appointed, which actually quotes the Declaration of Principles by written by Doctors for Cannabis Regulation several times in their report. And we're very honored by that. And our message, I think, is a very straightforward one. The message is really threefold: that prohibition is harmful, that it's ineffective, and that it's unnecessary. Prohibition is harmful because of the arrests. And I'm going to let other people emphasize the importance of the social justice arguments regarding the disparity, racial disparities in arrests and the effects on poverty. Poverty also being a public health issue, because nothing limits access to healthcare like poverty. And so when we're talking about the public health effects of cannabis, we can't fail to talk about the horrible health effects of cannabis prohibition. So cannabis prohibition itself is very harmful. And the prohibition itself has led to the proliferation of synthetic cannabinoids, which are far more dangerous than cannabis itself. And the effect on communities of color is of course, beyond dispute. Prohibition is also ineffective in its most basic intent, which was to keep cannabis away from young people. You know, Doctors for Cannabis Regulation in our mission statement says that we are very much dedicated to making sure that our description of the health effects of cannabis are neither exaggerated nor minimized. And that's, I think, an important point for our platform of education. We need to educate the public that there is a difference between adult use and underage use. Underage use, other than in limited medical circumstances, is always a bad idea because of the degree to which it can affect development of the brain. That said, cannabis prohibition has far from prevented underage use, and in some ways has probably increased it. And the way we know that is by the government's own statistics, that 80 to 90% of 18-year-olds in the United States for decades have reported easy access to cannabis if they want to obtain it. Also, in the same time that underage tobacco and alcohol use has gone down among underage individuals, cannabis rates went up for decades as well. It has now leveled off, and it's interestingly, it has leveled off in the age of legalization, and I can explain a bit more about that. Prohibition is also ineffective if you're trying to prevent adults from using it, when about 22, well, by the last statistics, which is actually early in legalization, 22 million Americans were using cannabis on a monthly basis. That number is probably higher now. The drug is not going away. And the feeling of Doctors for Cannabis Regulation is, if it is going to be there, then it behooves us as a society, and it behooves doctors to advocate for proper regulation of the drug to benefit public health. The third point I would make is that prohibition is fundamentally unnecessary. The great majority of adults are unharmed by the occasional use of cannabis. There are three specific adult groups that should not use cannabis other than for medically supervised purposes. Pregnant women, people with certain psychiatric disorders, and people who are prone to substance abuse in certain cases. For the rest of Americans, it is far less harmful to adults than alcohol and tobacco by nearly every measure. And there is also, contrary to the claims of the opposition, happy to expand on this further, to say that there really is no evidence, there has never been any evidence that cannabis is a causal gateway to the use of harder drugs. Insofar as there is a correlation, it's pretty clear now that it's not causation, because the great majority of people who use cannabis never go on to use harder drugs. And the fact that people who use drugs like heroin and methamphetamine had at some point in the past also used cannabis is not really saying much, except that the use of soft drugs tends to precede the use of hard drugs. Just because you see that the wind is turning, that the wind is blowing faster when windmills are turning faster, does not mean that windmills are producing the wind. I'm sorry, I said that awkwardly, but to put it properly, when windmills are turning faster, the wind is blowing faster, but that doesn't mean that the windmills created the wind. And so this misattribution of cause and effect has been a source of painful ignorance around the issues of the health effects of cannabis. And it's also the cause of a great deal of suffering. When you look at the totality of everything that cannabis prohibition has done to society and compare that to the relative lack of harm of cannabis use by adults. And so that's the reason why Doctors for Cannabis Regulation strongly supports legalization of cannabis for adults and regulation of the industry to protect public health. And I'm sure you guys will have lots of questions, and I'll be very happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, David. Our next speaker is Lisa Tain. She's a school board member in Westchester County, and she'll speak to the need for legalization as a parent and as someone who has been deeply involved in educational issues. Lisa?
Thank you so much. I just wanted to round that out by saying my background is also as a lawyer for legal aid, representing abused and neglected children and defending delinquents, which first opened my eyes to the injustices around these issues and helped inform my beliefs. A parent of three girls, also a foster parent, and I've been active in education for over 20 years with the PTA and boards of education and working with a group to prevent child abuse and neglect. So it's from this framework that I think we need to face the reality that, as the doctor just explained, that the war on drugs and prohibition does not work. And let's not forget that its origins had nothing to do with public health, that these laws making drugs illegal had everything to do with discrimination. And I'm sure you can go back to the Nixon administration and hear the quotes yourself about why these laws came into being. When there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. Having kids who have now been through high school and college, any student knows how to buy pot if they want it. In fact, the states where it has been legalized, the youth use has remained stable. And, you know, some people try to say that, well, you know, I'm okay with decriminalization, but not legalization. But decriminalization is not enough. We've had over 800,000 New Yorkers arrested in a 20-year period under those decriminalization laws. And they, again, and the racial does not address the social justice issues or the safety of the product. The racial disparities in enforcement and collateral damage are particularly disturbing and unacceptable. As Cassandra alluded to, collateral consequences on Black and Latino citizens have been far-reaching and tragic. Arrests have blocked the ability to get a loan, get a job, go to college, or access public housing, caused deportation of immigrants due to decades-old marijuana arrests, and particularly dear to my heart, has caused children to be removed from their families. And finally, there was the case of four 12-year-old Black girls who were strip searched at their school just recently for giggling in the hallway, and the thought was they were stoned. So we can't wait. The damage is still being done. And what you gain from legalization is the ability to control and regulate the supply, a safer product, and we can use the money for education to educate around the real dangers of the abuse of drugs with reality-based conversations using a safety-first curriculum the Drug Policy Alliance can provide for you. And also we would have the money in these schools to provide counseling for the underlying conditions that lead those children who do abuse to help them with those underlying causes, and also focus on the dangers of mixing drugs and driving. We can better restrict minors' access to marijuana, increase the accessibility for those with medical needs, and put these tax dollars to better use. In 2010, for example, $650 million was spent on prohibition, which is, as the doctor explained, is completely ineffective and unnecessary. Finally, the overwhelming majority of the community members support legislation. New York is not a state where we can have a referendum. We have to do this by legislation. And people have spoken and want it to be legal. And personally, I have to say that I would rather smoke a joint than have a drink. And I resent that the government has decided that it's okay for me to have alcohol, which is far more dangerous, and not okay for me to smoke pot and to have access to a safe product. There's no rational reason that makes this acceptable. The state and community I live in should allow responsible adults to choose for themselves, and we must. But far more important is that we end the damage that's being done by the prohibition to our minority communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa. Our next speaker is Corey Pagese. He's a former NYPD precinct commander, now with Law Enforcement Action Partnership. He recently published a New York Daily News op-ed calling for legalization and has testified to the New York State Assembly in support of legalization. Take it away, Corey.
Yes, good afternoon, everyone. Sorry for my technical difficulties, but I'm here now. I've heard, I think, the last two speakers. I totally agree with everything. But from a law enforcement perspective, let me just tell you, after 21 years of being in New York City Police Department and commanding some of the most violent precincts in the city of New York, I have up and close personal effect of what has happened, the war on drugs. We've been doing it for over three decades now. And what are we police doing today? The war on drugs is the same thing. You know, most recently I've been saying, my motto has been, you can't arrest your way out of drug addiction. It's, in my opinion, it's a medical issue. I have seen the effects of what happens when you arrest somebody for a dime bag of weed on a Friday, and after it's been Saturday and Sunday in jail, Monday go to court, which means they have to miss work and they get fired just for such a low-level crime. And that's the breadwinner of the house. And what happens is when you put these people in jail and they start losing their jobs and they're really not criminals, what we do create are criminals, because now they have to come home. They're almost like wolves or animals in the jungle. When an animal is hungry, they have to eat. So they're going to resort to any and every method to try to feed their family. And it's going to be beyond selling drugs. Now you become a robber. Now you become the guy that's stealing the cars or the guy that's breaking into homes, all because of low-level crimes. Breaking up the family and the family cycles, it goes generations. I've watched that in Brownsville, Brooklyn, and East New York. Brownsville, most importantly, because it's only one square mile and 12 different housing development, or what they call projects, in one consolidated place. And it's just a revolving door of police locking up young black and brown kids for low-level offenses such as smoking marijuana joint out in public. And it really affects the relationship between the community and police. So it's hard for me as a commander to try to bridge the gap between the community and police. But I'm telling the parents, aunts and uncles, that we're really trying to help these young men when all they're seeing is their kids, their sons and daughters getting locked up by my policemen. We're saying, hey, in New York City, we're trying to back off of making arrests of young black and browns. And yet, granted, the numbers have gone down, hundreds of thousands. But when you look at the numbers, the thousands that are still arresting are still black and brown, and all the studies are still showing that everybody smoked marijuana on the same level. So to alleviate it, the police need to be taken out of it. And what people don't realize is police officers don't even want to deal with those low-level offenses. They don't even want to deal with them. And one of the reasons police don't even want to deal with these low-level crimes is because every single encounter that a police officer has with somebody could be the last day that they're on earth. And God forbid a cop is under pressure to make a marijuana arrest and he or she gets murdered for trying to arrest somebody for a dime bag of weed. I mean, that's just where it is right now. Law enforcement almost around the country. I just came from Seattle, and you know, they're illegal out there. And I think Cassandra has said earlier, arrest. What we're doing now, in like Seattle and these other states, they're able to refocus and now actually move the police officers that was doing all these low-level crimes, and now you actually have them doing the seven major crimes, from homicide to, you know, down to rape or grand larceny auto. And that's what police officers really, really want to do. They want to go out there, protect and serve. I mean, you know, who am I to tell somebody to, you know, not smoke a marijuana cigarette? And, you know, the previous speaker just said, like, alcohol, you regulate it, you go into a liquor store, you can drink all you want. Cops don't want to deal with this marijuana. With 10 states online already, it's time for New York, supposedly the most progressive state in the country, to come online.
Thank you, Corey. We're now going to open up the Q&A portion of our teleconference. So on your Zoom screen there, if you have a question, you can raise your hand by clicking on the hand button on the control bar there. And we'll, as people ask questions, we can go through them one by one. Caroline,
can you hear me?
Hey, there we go. Yeah.
It was asking me to allow my microphone to be usable. Okay,
great. Glad you made it.
So I'm a freelance journalist. I've covered marijuana legalization in the past. I frequently write for Gothamist. But one thing I'm interested in is, you know, I've heard that in other places, even when marijuana is legalized, there's still arrests of, you know, kids who might be using it underage, and those arrests are still, you know, racialized. And I'm wondering how we can ensure that legalization, you know, what measures you guys are pushing for that can ensure that legalization addresses issues that haven't been addressed.
That's a great question, Caroline. This is Cassandra from Drug Policy Alliance. One of the things that we would say is that legalizing cannabis is not going to deal with the underlying root of racially biased policing. What cannabis regulation can do is remove or lessen the tool of being able to use cannabis as a way to engage with young people of color. What I would say is that one of the things that the work and the bills that we have been supporting here in New York do really work to remove criminalization as a tool to deal with young people in general. So by removing criminalization of young people around cannabis. In addition, part of the work that we have been elevating is that we're trying to remove the smell of cannabis as a reason for law enforcement to engage with anyone. And that is something that has also often been used as a way to target and engage with young people of color, as we've seen in other states. In addition, I would also say that part of the conversation around why, you know, if you look at the history of our work around marijuana reform in New York, it has always been heavily connected to our work around policing reform. And that, you know, as people continue to do cannabis regulation and reform work around the country, recognizing that the model that we had in New York was about figuring out how do we deal with biased policing and how do we deal with cannabis arrests at the same time. And you'll look, if you look at the decrease of stop and frisk in a place like New York City, you will also see the decrease in cannabis arrests because those two things are linked. It's part of the reason why Drug Policy Alliance has really moved away from the talking point that legalization ends discrimination, because it does not, right? It just lessens the encounters that could lead to discrimination. And one of the ways that that is reflected in the cannabis legislation that we're supportive of is by removing criminalization of young people, and also getting rid of the different loopholes that are often left in place for cannabis to be used as a reason for law enforcement to engage with communities around the state.
Thanks. Next, we're gonna open up the line for Jack Savage. We just opened up your line, Jack. Can you try speaking? Jack, I think we have you on the line now. Well, one thing I'll just add while we're waiting for Jack to come on the line here, following up on Caroline's question, it's important to note that in each of the states that have legalized marijuana so far, arrests for marijuana have gone down across the board for people of all racial backgrounds. But as Cassandra noted, the racial disparities in the remaining arrests have persisted. And one of the ways in some states where people have continued to be criminalized is for using underage. In California, I mentioned Prop 64 earlier, which had some of the model policies we're seeking in New York. And in California, instead of being arrested, people under 21 are referred to a sort of educational program where they can take a class to learn more about cannabis and its potential risks and benefits. And so we're hoping to build on that in New York and New Jersey, New Mexico, and other states where we're currently pursuing marijuana legalization legislation. So it looks like Jack is having, isn't able to get his mic to work. So I guess we'll open it up and see if anyone else has a question. You can go ahead and raise your hand on the control panel there on Zoom, and we'll open up your line. Does anyone else have any other questions? I know a few of you very likely do. Oh, okay. Jack sent his question via text, so I'll go ahead and read it. His question is, so marijuana legislation wasn't passed in the budget, and you said you will try to pass it through standalone legislation. How exactly will you go about doing that? I hand this over to Cassandra first.
Yeah, so currently there has been cannabis legalization legislation in Albany since 2013. And so we will work with our allies and our legislation sponsors to pass the bills in both houses, either in the both in the Assembly and the Senate. And so we will be working to push those bills through committee, and we'll continue to be meeting with elected officials, doing public education events throughout the state, and really just trying to rally the legislative support to pass it through the system of passing a standalone bill in New York's legislature.
And can I just add, Cassandra, this is Lisa, that the if people are for marijuana legislation, anytime that they contact their senators or their assembly people to let them know that they support it, that is very helpful.
Yeah. And to your follow-up point, Jack, where you asked, do you think it will actually pass? I think there's a strong desire from the legislature to get this done. I think you can take from the fact that cannabis legalization was something that was highly watched in the budget process, that the votes are potentially there to move it forward. And so I think there is a very good chance that we can push for cannabis legalization by the end of June.
Great. We have another question from Emily Rusco, who I believe is on the line. Are you there, Emily? Do we have Emily on the line? She appears to have technical difficulties as well. So She's going to type her question.
Hi there.
Are you able to hear? Oh,
hello. How's it going?
Hey.
I was hoping that Andrew, you might be able to speak to the strategy and ongoing talks with legislators who've expressed hesitation to commit to legalization in the Senate and the Assembly this year.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're going to see that we will be engaging in is regular advocacy, which is meeting with the elected officials, trying to figure out what their concerns are, trying to walk through the different issue, bringing folks in like David and Lisa and Corey to meet with them to get their questions answered, and trying to see if we can get their support either by them signing on as a co-sponsor of the bill or by getting them to commit that they will vote yes if the bill comes down to the floor.
And do you have any sense of what the approximate vote counts might look like at this point? I mean, or can you speak to, you know, how much of a need there is to persuade people, or what some of the themes are of those conversations that you've had thus far?
Mm-hmm. Great question. I think we're not gonna, I think we know that the support is there because, again, it was a very big issue within the budget season, so in budget prospect, which means that there's enough support in both the conferences to get this over the finish line. And we're not naive that the budget gives legislators political cover to take braver votes that they would not usually take on a standalone. And so I think part of the work that you'll be seeing advocates do is really shoring up those that will take a little bit more work to live through political courage to make sure that we can get this done this spring.
Great, thank you so much.
No problem.
All right, thanks. One last call, not seeing any other questions right now. If anyone else has a question, please raise your hand in Zoom and we'll open up your line. Going once, going twice, still not seeing anyone. All right. Well, I think we'll go ahead then and wrap up today's call. Really appreciate all of you joining. Please follow up with me afterwards if you'd like a recording of the call or have any follow-up questions for Cassandra or any of today's guests. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining. Really appreciate it. Have a good one.